The Magnificent Seven, they were known as. Kensal Green, Norwood, Abney Park, Brompton, Tower Hamlets, Nunhead, and, most famous of all, Highgate Cemetery. The Victorian Valhalla. Oh, this will be the death of me.
Bye now!
Yeah, see you soon. Horse-drawn hearses back in fashion. I never thought I'd live to see the day. Oh, through these heavy cast-iron gates have passed mortal remains of more than 168,000 souls. All on their final journey to the hillside beyond. There they lie beneath the tangled roots of holly and ivy, all of it self-rooted from a million floral tributes, resting peacefully in the graves which my father, his father, and his father before him dug for them. Oh, come through into the office. Well, I call it the office. Originally, it was the gatekeeper's lodge. When Highgate opened in 1839, he used to stand out there in his green uniform and topper in all weathers. So there was always a fire in the grate and a kettle on the hob. Nowadays, this is where the ledger is kept. A complete register of every burial here in the cemetery, from Elizabeth Jackson on the 26th of May, 1839, opening day, right up to the present. It's the Book of Death. Oh, excuse the clock. My little nephew brought it back from Florida. There's quite a few famous names in here. Dickens, Marx, George Eliot, Rossetti. People who shaped the Victorian British Empire. But Highgate is still a working cemetery, you know. And though burials are few and far between these days, there are quite a few names written in here during the last 50 years which might jog a few memories. Here, for instance, 1944, William Smith. He was better known as Wilkie Bard, the performer who started the vogue for singing tongue-twisting songs like She Sells Seashells on the Seashore. She'd be wet through if you were standing here right now and all. Then in 1970, there's Patrick Weimark, star of The Power Game, and Philip Arben, one of the first television cooks. And very recently, there's Françoise-Marie Bourbon d'Orléans, or Opal Whiteley, as was her given name. If your memory stretches right back to 1920, you just might recall the publication of her best-selling childhood diary and its tales of the fairies that lived in the wood and the singing creek where the willow grow, and the mysterious episode which followed. Some reckon that Opal's curious life story is the most fascinating literary enigma of the 20th century. I read that somewhere. Look, I'll tell you the whole remarkable story and you can make up your own mind. It all began in 1905 in Cottage Grove, a small logging community deep in the Cascade Mountains of Oregon, United States of America. Young Opal Stanley Whiteley sat down on her front porch, took out her wax crayons, and began to write on the back of a used and crumpled brown paper bag.
Today the folks are gone away from the house we do live in. They are gone a little way away to the ranch house where the grandpa does live. I sit on the steps, and I do print. I like it, this house we do live in, being on the edge of the near woods. So many little people do live in the woods. I do have conversations with them.
Opal! Opal! Will you stop your modeling, scribbling, and come on, you good-for-nothing little minx? Grandpa's waiting on you.
I'm coming, Mama.
Oh, that girl. She lives in a world of her own. She could daydream her whole life away, I swear. Well, she talks to her animals a good deal more than to her own family. It makes me so mad, Pa.
No, you're too hard on her, Lizzie. You were just the same at her age, and just as stubborn, too.
Yeah, Mama used to whip me just the same. She's a queer girl, right enough. Well, then she ain't chattering or asking questions. She loses herself in brown study. Her latest thing is her diary. You won't let no one see it. Says it contains all her secret thoughts. She talks to the trees, you know, Pa.
Well, nothing wrong with that. It's trees are fed and clothed this family for nigh on 50 years. Her diary won't stay a secret for long should her sisters find it.
Oh, she hides it. Keeps it in a hollow log in the forest somewheres. Oh, I don't know. Sometimes, well, she's not my child.
Opal, will you move your butt? Else you won't sit down for a week.
I think Opal should have hidden her diary down the back of her breeches. Proper writing paper was so scarce in Cottage Grove that Opal wrote on anything she could lay her tiny hands on. And sometimes the scraps of paper she begged, stole or borrowed were only big enough to take one letter of the alphabet. But every day she religiously wrote down, in her own phonetic language, details about her life, of her ramshackle home, her escapades in the surrounding forest, of the fairies she met amongst the cathedral of trees, and of her animal friends, all of whom she had named after famous people she'd read about in a history book.
Today was a warm, hot day. I carried water to the hired men in the field, and they were glad. Afterwards, I made little vases out of clay and put them in the oven to bake. The mama found my vases, and she threw them out the window, and they were broken. I felt sad inside. I went to talk things over with my chum, Michelangelo, the tall fir tree that grows just back of the barn. It is such a comfort to nestle up to Michelangelo when one is in trouble. He has an understanding soul. After I talked with him, I slid off the wrong limb in the wrong way and landed in the pig pen on top of Aphrodite, the mother pig. Mama saw me, and I got a spanking with the hazel switches that grow near unto our back steps. The back part of me feels a bit sore. But I am happy, listening to the twilight music of God's good world.
Oh, it's bell ringing practice night up at St. Michael's Church at the top of the hill. I sweetly tolling men do call to taste on meat that feeds the soul. It's an interesting fact that English bells are a lot smaller than ones on the continent. I mean, I know in these days of a common market, it is indelicate to mention national idiosyncrasies, but it's a fact that Britain's campanologists are renowned across Europe for their small clappers.
Oh,
it's this book. My great-grandfather used to take snuff, and I'm sure there's some of it still trapped between the pages. Oh, that's cleared me ears. Oh, thank heaven for that. Over in Oregon, Opal Whiteley was soon ringing a few bells of her own. Early in 1915, at the age of 17, she was elected state president of Junior Christian Endeavor, a religious movement dedicated to the improvement of spiritual awareness. Later that year, Opal was invited to speak at the University of Oregon in Eugene, 20 miles away down the road. And come the day, the hall was packed with city folk curious to see this young girl from the backwoods make a fool of herself in front of the university faculty. In the event, quite the opposite proved true. Opal stunned the audience and university professors alike with her knowledge of natural history and geology. Within days, Opal had left home and enrolled as a freshman at the University of Oregon. I wonder if in these days of political correctness, they call it a fresh person. Anyhow, the usual entrance rules were cast aside, and Opal was soon attending classes in biology, botany, geology, and geography. During the next 2 years, she devoured knowledge like a person starved, borrowing more books from the library than anyone else in the history of the school. Actually, she was a person starved. The scholarship had never materialized, and money was so tight that her room in a small shack on the outskirts of the town contained little more than a $2 cot and a few overcoats for blankets. In the spring of 1917, Opal astounded the university once again, but not quite in the way they expected. She up sticks and left.
I'm writing to advise you that I will be unable to complete my studies at the University of Eugene and am resigning the faculty forthwith. As I'm sure you are well aware, I have received practically no funding during the past 2 years and have strived to improve my education whilst waging a continual and wearisome battle against hunger. I find that I have $20 to support myself over the coming semester, and therefore, I have no option but to search for employment. Yours, Opal Whiteley. Oh, I'm so cold.
Whew. There's a devil of a draft coming from somewhere. Either that or someone's just walked over my grave. Now, that would make a change. Well, Opal's search for work in Eugene proved fruitless, and admitting defeat, she turned to the only thing she knew to make money, nature. She started to give lessons to the children of wealthy Californians and became so popular that she started work on a book, written specifically for kids, with a view to publication. The only problem was her lack of readies, but she solved the dilemma with breathtaking ingenuity.
Theodore Roosevelt, I'm writing to ask for your kind approbation on the enclosed essay. It is the first chapter of a book I have planned on the natural world, written especially for children, and entitled The Fairyland Around Us. I have already received advance orders for my proposed publication from, amongst others, Queen Elizabeth of Belgium and King George V of Great Britain. And should you wish to subscribe a nominal sum, I would be delighted to reserve a copy for you also. Yours respectfully, Opal Whiteley. There. Who's next? Ah. Dear Mr. Rothschild, I'm writing to ask for your kind approbation on the enclosed.
Well, believe it or not, Opal's plan worked. She netted more than $9,400 in advance payments from some of the most affluent families of America and Europe. By December 1918, the first few hundred copies of Unbound Pages had rolled off the press. But it didn't quite go to plan. The printers took her to the cleaners and demanded an additional $600 to finish publication, money which Opal simply didn't have. So they ceased work and destroyed the type and plates. Opal spent the next 6 months binding the books herself, and most of her subscribers duly received their copies. Theodore Roosevelt got his, but Opal was back to square one. No money and no job.
Receptionist required for theatrical agency. Must have previous experience. No. Waitress for Italian restaurant. Must be fluent. No? What's this? Established publishing house seeks new authors. Atlantic Monthly of Boston require unpublished works for inclusion in its expanding catalog. Please forward manuscripts for the attention of Ellery Sedgwick, editor. I'll do more than that, Mr. Sedgwick. I'll deliver it to you in person.
Late one afternoon in September 1919, Opal walked into the Atlantic office with a copy of The Fairyland Around Us under her arm and presented it to Ellery Sedgwick. He carefully studied the book, noted with admiration the marks of special loving care on its binding, then turned to Opal and said,
"I'm afraid we can't do anything with this book, Miss Whiteley.
Oh.
Please don't be too disappointed. It's a pretty book, but it's not for us. Where are you from?
The Cascade Mountains. Cottage Grove.
Oh, Oregon. Yeah, that's logging country, unless I'm mistaken.
I've lived most of my life in logging camps.
You must have had an unordinary life, Miss Whiteley. I envy you. Old America is dying, you know that. Not so long ago, we were a farming nation and lived close to nature. Now, in these days of cities, of fast-moving automobiles, hot jazz and radio and the like, folk look back on those austere hardships of yesteryear through rose-tinted spectacles. Do you miss the mountains, Miss Whiteley?
Very much. I miss the people, too. But mostly I miss my old pet friends.
Pet friends?
Yes. Felix Mendelssohn, my mouse, and Aristotle, my pet bat. He died of eating too many mosquitoes. Then there's Clementine. She was a beautiful Plymouth Rock hen. And Peter Paul Rubens. He was such a dear pig.
What? You had a pet pig?
Several. Solomon Grundy was my favorite.
Do you keep a diary, Miss Whiteley?
As a child, I did.
Then it's not this book I want, Opal, but your childhood diary.
It's destroyed. It's all torn up.
Destroyed? How?
My little sister, Faye. I used to keep my diary secret, hidden in a hollow log in the forest. I wrote down everything. I don't know why I'm telling you this.
No. Go on.
Faye found it and tore it to pieces when I was about age 12. End of story.
You've kept the pieces?
Why, yes. I've kept everything. It's all in a couple of hat boxes I have in storage in Los Angeles.
Opal, we will telegraph for those hat boxes immediately. And when they arrive, I will personally contract you to reassemble the diary as it was. This could be the book the American public has been waiting for.
The hat boxes duly arrived from L.A. a few days later, and inside they contained more than 500,000 pieces of shredded paper. It took Opal almost 9 months to piece the diary back together, and to complicate matters, she kept on coming across phrases which made no sense. Ellery Sedgwick cast an experienced eye over the problem and surprised Opal with his conclusion.
Le champ de fleurs, hyacinthe, dauphinel, et souci.
This is French, Opal.
French? How could it be? I don't speak French. I have no knowledge of the language.
Well, you did once. You must have to have written this. You don't remember?
I don't understand.
When the diary was published in September 1920 with the title Opal Whiteley, The Journal of an Understanding Heart, America went crazy for it. Within 2 weeks, it had raced to the top of the bestseller list. Overnight, Opal became famous, hailed as a fairy princess, intuitively in touch with nature. Parents were buying the book for their children, the kids were buying it for their friends, everyone was talking about it, and none more so than the townsfolk back in Cottage Grove. In the foreword to the book, Opal made an extraordinary claim, you see. She declared that Ed and Lizzie Whiteley were not her natural parents, and claimed her real father, her angel father, as she called him in the diary, was Henri Duc d'Orléans, an exiled French prince and celebrated explorer who had secretly married his cousin, Princess Marie, Opal's mother.
And there was Father in the few days when he was home from far lands. Those were wonderful days, his homecoming. Then he would take me on his knee and ride me on his shoulder and tell me of the animals and birds of far lands. There was one day when I went with Mother in a boat. It was a little way on the sea. It was a happy day. Then something happened and we were all in the water. Afterwards, when I called for Mother, they said the sea waves had taken her and she was gone to heaven. I remember that day because I never saw my parents again.
The fairy princess was in reality a French one. When the press got hold of the story, they descended on Cottage Grove in their droves, but they were too late. The Whiteleys had disappeared. They had changed their name and moved out of the area, never to be seen or heard of again. The extra publicity sent the book into orbit, and soon Opal was on her way here to London, where the reviews had been equally ecstatic. But Britain's love affair with Opal lasted only a few months, as rumours began to filter through from the States that at a dinner party some months previously, Opal had confided to a friend that she had faked the entire diary. Well, London society, not to be outdone by its colonial counterpart, was soon agog with rumour and speculation.
Do you believe in fairies?
Obviously a forgery. The whole bally thing is preposterous.
Opal's diary offers a wide field of theory, speculation and...
You've heard the D'Orléans family have completely disowned her.
I returned it to the bookshop and demanded my money back. The woman's either a brilliant liar or totally insane.
Tinkle, tinkle, crash, crash, crash.
Every time a child says, "I don't believe in fairies," there is a little fairy somewhere that falls down dead.
Opal didn't fall down dead, but something died inside. The arguments over the diary's pedigree raged on and on, and soon the public became convinced they were the victims of a hoax and stopped buying it. 2 years after publication, all copies of the diary were removed from the bookshelves, and Opal, or Françoise Marie Bourbon d'Orléans, as she preferred to be known, slipped ever deeper into obscurity. During the Blitz, she became well known to the booksellers of the Charing Cross Road, hawking dog-eared volumes she'd found in bombed-out buildings, habitually searching their piles of mouldering hardbacks for proof of her nobility. In 1948... health visitors found her starving in a squalid basement bed sitting room off Haverstock Hill. Her only possessions? 15,000 books, stacked from ceiling to floor, all of them about the French royal family. Opal was judged unfit to take care of herself and admitted to an asylum on the outskirts of London near St. Albans, where staff and patients alike knew her as Françoise Marie Bourbon d'Orléans, or Princess for short. She lived there, a princess at last, for 44 years. On her death in 1992, at the age of 95, she was buried here at Highgate under her assumed name.
Now are come the days of brown leaves. They fall from the trees, they flutter on the ground. When the brown leaves flutter, they say little things. They talk with the wind. I hear them tell of their borning days, when they did come into the world as leaves, how they were part of the earth and air before their tree-borning days. And now they are going back. In gray days of winter, they go back to the earth again, but they do not die.
So, was Opal's story true? Was she the daughter of a French prince, as she claimed? Or did she dream up the whole affair? The truth is, I've no idea. But here's an interesting couple of facts. An American professor ran tests on the scraps of paper which go to make up one single page of the original diary and discovered that they all dated from before the First World War, from the time of Opal's childhood. And there's also one particular rhyme in the diary which poses a curious conundrum.
Jean de Seine de Havre et son ninonette, et roulon et iron et dans les tal et oug. Et oui, les loin et our et
del e non et e sarc.
In the lullaby, which Opal claimed she learnt at her angel mother's knee, she sings of French rivers and streams. The names of the rivers are those which only a true-born Frenchman would have known. And the weird truth is, if you take the first letter from each line of the lullaby and join them all together, they spell out the name Henri d'Orléans. Well, there we have it. The strange, sad tale of Opal Whiteley. This old ledger, like the cemetery, is practically full nowadays. And it won't be too long until the last name is added and both are closed for the last time. Oh, well, I'd better disappear off home. Otherwise, my missus will see to it that my name's written in here first thing in the morning. If you've time to spare, pop by again soon and I'll tell you more about Highgate and yet another extraordinary sexton's tale. Ta-da for now.
In the Sexton's Tales, George Cole played the sexton, and appearing in the cast were John Baddeley, Roger May, Dan Strauss, Emlyn Harris, Melanie Hudson, and Jill Graham. The programme was written by Emlyn Harris, produced by Neil Rosser, and was a Rewind IBN production for Radio 2.